everyone. Welcome to episode 13 of Mic Check on Sports. I'm Steve Napolitani. I know a lot of my guests have been hockey-centric, but don't worry. I plan to have a variety of guests from the NBA, Major League Baseball, and MLS. My next guest is a former goalkeeper for the U.S. national team. He was teammates of Pele's on the New York Cosmos, and he's currently an analyst for the New York Red Bulls on MSG Networks. It's the great Shep Messing. Shep, how are you?
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me on. Good.
Thanks for coming on. And obviously, we're going through tough times these days, and everybody's sheltered at home. How are you spending your time?
Yeah, actually, I'm fortunate in that I'm not holed up in a small place. I'm on Long Island, so I've got a backyard. I've got a dog. I've got a family. So, not horrendous circumstances for me. And I think, you know, like many of us who are in the sports world, we're running out of things to do. So I'm reading a lot of books. I'm watching movies and series on Netflix and thinking about sports all the time.
Yeah. And there's been some positive talk about the MLS possibly coming back in mid-June. There's some rumors about that. So that's one positive that I'm hearing.
Yeah, look, we're all speculating and nobody knows for sure. I would think, given the nature of soccer in general, you know, it's outdoors, given the nature of where Major League Soccer is, you know, they're in their 25th year. But I think, Steve, they're more dependent on playing than I think the other leagues. The other leagues have more stability. So, you know, Don Garber and the league office have been very upfront and trying to be out ahead of it, saying, look, we're going to do everything we can to play a full 34-game schedule. And if not, we're going to play as many games as we can. Of course, nobody knows what the next month, 2-3 months looks like. But I think Major League Soccer is one of the pro leagues that's going to be ahead of it and do anything they can to play.
Right. Well, you said you were on Long Island. You were born in the Bronx, grew up on Long Island. What was your childhood like?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Steve. You know, I look at my life now and I spent close to 16 years as a professional player and 20 years in the broadcast booth with Madison Square Garden. And I didn't even see a soccer ball until I was 16. I mean, it was the furthest thing from my mind, Steve. I was born in the Bronx, grew up my early childhood there, used to sneak into Yankee Stadium, and I was strictly the baseball, football, basketball until I was 16 years old. And you know, look, back in those days, you didn't play one sport, you played every sport.
Right.
But, you know, soccer wasn't even on my radar screen until I was I'll never forget it, obviously. I was a sophomore in high school, I was a running back in football, and our football program at the high school had a devastating injury, and they canceled the season and they put football on hold. Oh. And so the soccer coach came up to me, and look, I was a good athlete, but he said, look, you know, you take a point guard in basketball or a shortstop in baseball, and you're a little bit crazy. I need a goalkeeper. I said, what do I have to do? He said, you do anything you want. Just keep the ball out of the net. So I was 16, and 3 years later, I was an All-American in college, and 5 years later, playing in the Olympics, and 6-7 years later, playing with Pelé. So it was the most unusual trajectory in the world. I never would have dreamed that I would have had this kind of life in sports.
And I mean, the soccer, obviously, it came natural to you. Did you enjoy it right away, or did it take you a while to warm up to it?
No, I hated it. I couldn't. It wasn't, you know, first game, Steve, I ever played. I told you about that high school coach coming up to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got all ready, and I sprayed stickum on my hands, and, you know, I put eye black under my eyes, and I went in the goal, and our team was really good, and I never touched the ball. I mean, the ball, I didn't do anything. I was pacing back and forth, and, you know, waving to my girlfriend on the sideline, and but look, I quickly fell in love with it, and I never could have been a field player. I liked the contact. I liked to be the guy. You know, you make a mistake, it goes up on the scoreboard. I like that mentality. And mm-hmm. you do have to be, I think if you speak to a goaltender in any sport, and I've worked out, you know, in my years as a pro, at one time we were playing when the Islanders were winning 4 Stanley Cups in a row. Mm-hmm. And I was playing indoor soccer. We won 4 titles in a row. And I used to work out with Smitty in the off season, Bobby Smith, mm-hmm. The Islanders goaltender. And we would, you know, there's similarities in the mentality.
Right.
If you're a goalkeeper in soccer, goaltender in hockey, I'm sure lacrosse the same. You got to be a little bit sick to be in the goal. But, you know, I eventually fell in love with the game.
And then you talked about college. You started at NYU, but finished at Harvard, 2-time All-American. You know, how did that kind of play out?
Well, I'm not proud of it. Because I'll tell you why I ended up leaving NYU. I was good, right? Mm-hmm. So I was an All-American my first year at NYU. But back then, the NYU campus was up in the Bronx, University Heights. And yeah, I'm not proud of it, but I ended up dropping my roommate out of the window. It was only the second floor.
Right.
He didn't get hurt that badly. But... But I sort of got kicked out, and I took a year off. During that year off, I had tried out and made the Olympic team, and then I had a buddy who was up at school at Harvard, and I applied to Harvard, never thinking I was going to get in, but lo and behold, I got in, and I went to Harvard, and we had a great team there. We went to the NCAA Final Four. We lost to St. Louis. I was an All-American again and you know, had a great time up in college. But again, every year for me, Steve, and I'm looking back how long it's been, mm-hmm. because of where soccer was at, I thought each year was the last year. So I graduated from Harvard and that summer went to the Olympics in Munich.
Mm-hmm.
We were the first U.S. soccer team ever to go through qualifying and actually get to the Olympic Games. And again, when the Olympics were over, I came home and I figured that's the end of soccer. And I found out that I was drafted in the first college draft ever by a team I never heard of, the Cosmos. So that, you know, we in pro soccer always say, you know, before Pelé and after Pelé. So I signed my first contract for a couple of $100 and again, you know, it was a 1-year thing.
Right.
I had gotten into Fordham Law School, planned to, you know, start law school in the fall. And then one day I pick up a newspaper and read that Pelé's signing on the team. So I still thought it was 1 year at a time. I played professionally 16 years, mm-hmm. but I signed a 1-year contract, free agent, for my entire career because wow. the sport was just taking off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I first played for the Cosmos, we played at, you know, Randall's Island and Hofstra, and we got 800 people at a game, and then all of a sudden Pelé landed,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't explode overnight, Steve. I mean, Pelé came and we were playing at Randall's Island, Downing Field. We were getting 15,000, 20,000 people a game. And then the next year they opened Giant Stadium. So we were the first in when Giant Stadium opened. And we were still getting, you know, 30,000 a game, 35,000. But one by one, that team signed the greatest players in the world. They mm-hmm. signed Canalia and then Franz Beckenbauer and then Carlos Alberto. And, you know, I'll never forget the day because I was still the Long Island kid. And, mm-hmm. and Franz and Pelé, they lived in the city at the Essex House. So so my job was to pick them up. I'd drive from Long Island. I'd drive into the city. I'd have to pick up Franz and Pelé and then chauffeur them through the Lincoln Tunnel to get to Giant Stadium. And I'll never forget the day it exploded because it was Father's Day in June of 1977, and I'm driving. We have a game at Giant Stadium against Tampa Bay, and I drive into the city. I pick up friends and Pele. They get in the back seat. I put my little. I always used to joke. I'm a Yankee fan, so I put a Yankee hat on like I'm their chauffeur, and we go through the Lincoln Tunnel, and it's bumper to bumper. I mean, I figured a truck overturned or something happened, and Franz Beckenbauer is very German. He's getting he's my good friend, so I can tease him. He's getting nervous. Shep, we're going to be late. Is he going to be late for the game? I said, Franz, I got you and Pele in the car, dude.
Game ain't starting.
They're not starting the game without us. So meanwhile, there was no traffic accident. It was a beautiful, gorgeous Sunday, Father's Day, against Tampa Bay, and 70,000 people showed up. Wow. So it just exploded. And, you know, people ask me, would I rather be playing today in Major League Soccer, you know, with Red Bulls, or would I rather be playing in Europe? I got to tell you, I wouldn't trade the time that I played for anything in the world. To think of a kid from the Bronx who never saw a soccer ball, and then I'm playing with the world's greatest players in front of 75,000 people. It was, again, you couldn't have scripted a movie for it, and it was just great.
Right, and, you know, as you mentioned, I'd like to backtrack a little. You said, you know, goalies are a little off. So I heard a story that you actually hitchhiked to St. Louis to try out for the U.S. national team. Is that a true story?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, all the stories you hear about me are true. Yeah, I had I had limited money, and I saw, because I had been an All-American in college, I was invited to the Olympic trials, and they were at SIU, same whatever it was, Southern Illinois, I guess where Clyde went.
Right, the Salukis.
Right. Yeah, the Salukis. So, you know, I get this invitation in the mail. You know, please be at the tryouts, whatever the date was. I'm going, again, I wasn't going to go to my mother and father and borrow money. They were not, you know, they wanted me to go to law school. They had no design on my being an athlete. So I said, how am I going to get out there? Well, you know, it was a different time. Right. And I stuck my thumb out. Wow. I packed some stuff in my bag, and I had no money. I mean, no money. So I hitchhiked. It took me about 4 days to get out there.
Wow.
Now I have no money, obviously, for a hotel. And the limited money I had, I said I could either buy food or beer. So I bought beer, right, just to stay hydrated. And it is a big moment in my life. So I'm out there. I've got no hotel. I go straight to training. I train. And I thought I played well. But I didn't. No, there was no notification after the tryout, so I hitched back to the St. Louis airport, and I slept in the airport by my gate, and I'll never forget the moment. You know, I'm sleeping there at the gate, and I woke up in time for the flight, and I grabbed the newspaper and a coffee, and that newspaper I saw for the first time. They listed here are the members of the U.S. men's soccer Olympic team.
Wow.
And I'm standing there, I haven't shaved, I'm drinking beer, I'm sleeping at the airport. And you know, you never know where life takes you, but that was a good trip for me.
How much of an honor was it to play for your country?
You know, people describe it in every sport, and it's the greatest honor you have. I think it doesn't matter what the sport is. And that's why you look at the guys in the NBA that came back and played the Olympics. That's the thrill of the lifetime. When you can't, it's indescribable when you put on a jersey and it says USA. And so tremendous amount of pride and tremendous amount of sacrifice. You know, I joke around, like all athletes, about you know, partying, drinking, all that. You got to work hard. I mean, if you have a dream, I mean, I spent years diving. I used to dive on my driveway, you know, asphalt, just to toughen up my body so that when I was in a game, it'd be like landing on a pillow.
Wow.
And And look, I remember when I was on the Olympic team, I still had a part-time job at a catering hall, and I was like a busboy, and I'd be setting the table for like 300 guests at a wedding, but I'd set 300 table settings with my left hand just to try and increase being ambidextrous, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are all kinds of sacrifices you make, but I think in the end, the rewards warrant it.
So then you play in the 1971 Pan Am Games, and then you went on to play, as you said, the 72 Summer Olympics in Munich. I read a quote from you that it was originally Disneyland, but it turned into the House of Horrors. You said that this was the turning point of your life as an athlete and as a Jew. Can you kind of talk about that experience?
You know, it's unbelievable, Steve, that it's still hard for me to talk about it even today, but of course I will, because again, I remember being 10 years old and having an Olympic party in my backyard, right? I mean, you dream of the Olympics, all of us kids, right? You dream of playing in the Super Bowl or you know, in the NBA Finals or Stanley Cup or the Olympics, right? The Olympics are on every kid's mind. So for me, hard to describe the elation, the pride of making that Olympic team, going down to, you know, we always went to the White House before we take off to go to the Olympic Games. You land in Munich, you've got all the swag, right? You can't wait to put on the USA sweatsuit and t-shirts and slippers and carry-on bags and you know, sport jackets, everything emblazoned with USA. And it's just, it's hard to describe the pride you take, opening ceremonies, you know, walking into that with the delegation from the U.S.
Which I heard you almost didn't do, right?
Yeah, I had a coach that, you know, look, I was a New York kid with long hair, sideburns, you know, a hippie. It was the 60s, the 70s. And Bob Gelker, you know, may he rest in peace, great man, but I fought with him every day because he was a Midwest, you know, crew cut, strict military type coach, and I don't think I was his favorite athlete, but so he insisted before the opening ceremonies that I cut my hair, you know, cut my sideburns and get hair. I said,
it wasn't the Yankees.
Yeah, coach, you gotta be kidding me, man. I'm from the Bronx. You know, I'm not cutting my hair. So, and he forbid us, me, from going into the opening day parade, and I just did it anyway. Right. So he ended up benching me for the first two games that we played. But look, those are moments where I worked my whole life. I'm at the stadium, I'm at the Olympics, I'm wearing the uniform, and you're telling me I can't march in the opening night. Say, that's not happening, pal. So, but, you know, he made it up by benching me in the first two games, and then he forced me to play against Germany. And Germany, at that time, they had legalized the pros playing. So that was, we were a bunch of college kids playing against basically Bayern Munich. And you know, to this day, I hold two Olympic records, and they still stand. One for the most saves ever made in a game. I think it was 53.
Wow.
Unfortunately, the second record is for the most goals allowed. I gave up seven. We lost 7-0. So, but again, it was one day at a time. I left the Olympics. I'll get back to your original question. So, look, you go from the height of elation representing your country to about 4 o'clock in the morning. One night, I get a knock at my door, and I open the door, and there are two German soldiers with machine guns asking if I'm Shep Messing. And I actually took a step back, not knowing whether I'm going to throw a punch or run.
Right.
And then they showed me their identification, and they said, you know, we're sorry, but there's been an attack on the Olympic Village, and we're taking all the Jewish athletes on the U.S. team into protective custody. Hmm. And they rounded up, there were 12 of us, including Mark Spitz, the swimmer.
Yeah.
And they put us in protective custody. The terrorists had attacked the village, the Israeli compound, and really my room was about 20 yards away. You go out on my balcony, I look right at the Israeli apartments. And the terrorists had scaled the fence, attacked the village, attacked and eventually murdered 11 Israeli coaches and athletes. But we were in protective custody for the duration, the Jews on the U.S. team. And it's hard to describe, of course, but when it was all over, I got on a plane and I flew home. You know, we were right in the heart of the attack. And actually, television back in those days, it was Jim McKay and Howard Cosell, and they had a television production facility at the Olympic Village. And you know, we'd see guys with masks on and guns on the balcony, and we didn't know what's going on. And you'd go to the television headquarters to actually watch what was being broadcast around the world. Wow. And obviously horrific. And look, security and terrorism back in those days, right, nothing like today. So the terrorists actually mimicked the athletes. You know, we were in Munich, and there was one main gate to the Olympic Village. And many of us, including me, we'd go out on the town. We'd go through the main entrance. We'd go into town. We're in Munich. We'd have some drinks. And when we came back, we would hop over the fence. There was no barbed wire. We'd be in our tracksuits. We'd hop over the fence, and we'd kind of wave to the guards at the main gate because we didn't want to clock in, right? And that's actually how the terrorists got in. They replicated what we did. They dressed in tracksuits. They hopped over the fence and waved at the guards. So obviously a different world than it is today, but I think the first time really terrorism struck the international sports stage.
Had it been so scary. I can't even imagine.
It was. My parents were there, you know, but incommunicado. They had my young brother. My parents were in Munich attending to watch me play, and there was no way to communicate with them. And it was a horrifying, horrifying time.
And then following the Olympics, you receive offers from teams in Mexico and Germany. But as you said, you decided to stay home and play with the Cosmos. What went into that decision?
You know, again, it's hard to describe how semi-pro it was. Right? It was really a bunch of ragtag. We were good players, right? But it was no Pelés and Beckenbauers and Cristiano Ronaldos. We were a bunch of All-American players, third, fourth division English players, and it was a part-time job, right? So I worked at the airlines at night, and I'd play in the German-American League on Sunday for a couple of $100. I'd play for the Cosmos Saturday night, and I'd teach at a high school during the week. It was really, I'll never forget how I signed my first contract, because, again, I was their draft choice, so the coach, Gordon Bradley, had me come down and train at Hofstra, and it was when Joe Namath and the Jets were practicing Hofstra. I'll get into some stories about me and Joe, but Gordon has me down at practice, and I train and I look good. And he said, you look good. Meet me at Burger King on Hempstead Turnpike after the game. I want to talk to you after practice. So I said, great. So we go to Burger King, and the coach orders a cheeseburger, French fries, and a Coke for me. And for him, he said, look, I think you're everything I thought you'd be. I think you have the makings of being a very good goalkeeper. And so I'll offer you what we typically offer, you know, our draft picks, $2,300. And I figure, you know, I'm a smart guy. I'm a Harvard guy. I'm going to negotiate with him. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, is it $2,300 a week, a month, a game? I didn't know what he meant. So I asked Gordon, I said, Gordon, is that per week, per month? He said, no, that's for the season. So I said, well, Gordon, what would you say if I told you I wanted to think about it? And he took a bite of his cheeseburger and he said, I couldn't care less. So it was a long way from where the sport is today. And again, it all changed the day that Pelé landed.
Right.
So we're getting, $200 a game, and Pelé signed a 3-year contract for, at the time, $7 million. And we all got the courage up to go in, and I actually helped form the first players union in the country. Huh. And we said, look, I mean, he's Pelé, but could you pay us a little more money? So the sport, that was, and look, I look at Major League Soccer today,
uh-huh,
how far they've come, and the stadiums that they've built, like Red Bull Arena.
Right.
It's come a long way, but I do think we take great pride that I think we were the first generation that laid the seeds for pro soccer here today.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you played with the Cosmos in two stints. In your first stint, I have to ask you about this, 1974, you end up posing nude in a magazine, effectively causing you to be released from the Cosmos.
But, you got all the goods on me.
I got all the goods on you.
But that's a good, all of my stories are good because they're true.
So, right.
So, you know, I told you, we were a raggy bunch. I'm not we're not making any money, mm-hmm, making a couple of $1,000s and Jim Boughton, Yankee pitcher. Yeah. So yeah. I knew, and I'll get back in the name if, you know, we all hung out. So when we were practicing, with the Jets, I met Namath. He got me my first Puma deal. He introduced me to Roger Bear and a bunch of other guys.
That's some group right there.
Derek Sanderson. We had a group. So somehow I hooked up and Boughton knew me, and Jim Boughton calls me one day and he goes, look, they're looking for a pro athlete in the New York metropolitan area who will pose for this magazine. And he said, I don't want to do it. What do you think? I said, hey, how much did they pay? He said, I think they pay $10,000. I said, are you kidding me? Of course I'll do it. So I told you I had been working three different jobs, mm-hmm, high school out here, the airport, and the Cosmos. And you know, I posed for the magazine, and I figured, much more than I was making playing for the Cosmos, and I posed in the magazine, but I figured never, you know, who's going to see it?
Right.
Well, one day I come into my high school the next day, and evidently remember, I'm about 22 years old. The high school girls are, 15, 16, 17 years old. So it must have come out on the newsstand, and all the girls in the high school were running into the bathroom and screaming and looking at the magazine. So the principal calls me in, and he said, you're fired. So I got fired from the high school. Then the Cosmos called me in and say that I violated a morals clause in the contract. Hmm. And I said, wait a second. First of all, there's no morals clause. Second of all, you're getting 800 fans a game. You told me you need publicity. Right. I got you more publicity, but they didn't buy it. And they put me on waivers. And ironically, my father was a lawyer, and we sued the Cosmos for back pay.
Hmm.
And it was a very quick lawsuit. At the end of the lawsuit, and I still have that letter framed today, from the president and general manager, a guy named Clive Toy, good friend of mine. So he wrote to me and he said, Shep, that was the most amicable lawsuit I've ever had. I wish you nothing but the best. And if I ever sign Pelé, I'll make sure his father is not a lawyer. And that was 3 years before. So evidently he was already hunting down Pelé to sign him. So I missed the boat, but that's how I first left the Cosmos.
Well, recently I watched a documentary, I'm not sure if you saw it, called Soccer Town USA, about Kearney, New Jersey, and how this town produced Tab Ramos, John Harkes, Tony Meola. In the documentary, yep, they talk about the influence of going to Cosmos games. Did you realize at that time the impact you were having on American soccer?
You know, I first of all, I got to see that movie. I haven't seen it.
It's tremendous.
But second of all, you know, I look up to those three guys. I know them for many, many years, Tab and Tony and John. And they've come to me many times over the years and told me the stories that must be in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that actually ball boys sometimes, you know, on the side, you know, when the ball is out, they give me the ball, Tab or Tony or Harkey, you know. So we didn't realize the impact we would have. We caught lightning in a bottle. So that, and you know, sports, Steve, that was the timing was right. Mm-hmm. I mean, Namath was gone. Walt Frazier, Clyde had just left the Knicks. I mean, there was a void in the marketplace. And those years at the 1977 Son of Sam, mm-hmm. the city was bankrupt, the blackout. I mean, it was a bad time in the city. I mean, the only star that really came in at that time was Reggie Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
But Clyde was gone, Namath was gone. There was a real need for somebody to catch the attention of sports in our city.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we felt. You know, we really felt, we didn't realize the impact it would have on generations of young players. But, you know, Steve, the one thing in the world that can really capture the imagination or raise a city on its shoulders are sports.
Right.
And the Cosmos took off. I mean, Studio 54, the back page of the Daily News, the back page of the Post. We were actually bigger in the media than the Giants or the Jets or the Yankees or the Mets. Mm. I mean, we were the story. And again, I'm that kid growing up in the Bronx, a Yankee fan. One of the highlights of my career is we played a game at Giant Stadium, 75,000 people there. We go to the city after, like we always did, mm-hmm. L.A. and Franz and Giorgio, whether we go to a restaurant or a Studio 54. And I never forget pulling up to the restaurant. I forget which one we went to. And I pull up to the restaurant. It's mobbed. You can't get in. And I see Reggie Jackson I think he had a purple Rolls Royce or maroon.
Hey.
And Reggie is trying to double park in front of the restaurant. And the maitre d' sees me, and I got Pelle and Giorgio with me, and he kicks Reggie out. And I said, you got to be kidding me. Pelle and Giorgio didn't understand. I said, do you understand they just kicked Reggie Jackson out to let us in?
That must have been something.
Yeah, I joke with Reggie about it later. He didn't think it was funny. But you know, to your point, we love the sport. I've never seen an ambassador in a sport when you talk about young kids like Pelé.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so many thousands of kids would come up to him and their parents and say, how do I become a great player? And Pelé would always say the same thing. Look, first you be a good person. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then don't, you know, just love the ball, love the game. He was just an icon for kids and adults alike. So, to your question, we didn't realize at the moment the impact we had, but hopefully it was a good one.
I think it was a good one. And, you know, still people talk about it to this day. You know, I got kids who play soccer, and everybody talks about those Cosmo days as being such a great influence. And, of course, they touch on that in that documentary. But after, you then went on to have a successful career in the major indoor soccer league. Like you said, you played so many years professional. Did you enjoy indoor soccer as much?
Yeah, you know, so different, Steve. I got to tell you, I loved it. I loved it because, you look, the goalkeeper outdoors, you got 80,000 people, your heart's in your stomach. One mistake, you lose the game.
Right.
Maybe you got to make five or six saves during a game. It's a mental game more than a physical game. I mean, outdoors, you have to be laser focused, concentrating for 90 minutes, whether you're touching the ball or not, to the point where the final whistle blew, I'm usually crying, just letting out the emotions. So, look, it's physical ability, but it's a mental game to stay locked in 90 minutes. And there are moments where you got to be big. in our championship game in Pelé's last game, I had to make a point blank save with 2 minutes to go. So you got to be locked in.
Mm-hmm.
Indoors, it's just like knock hockey, ping pong. If you're a kamikaze, you know, you're like a maniac. 60 shots a game, blocking it, rebounds off the glass. So I love the indoor. Plus, you could get up and initiate the attack, right? And I'm throwing the ball like the baseball player I am. I actually kind of invented the fast break indoors, where I had a teammate, Steve Jungle, who was the best player in the league, and I would diagram plays for him, right? Hmm. Where I'd take the ball and I'd want him, you know, same in football. I'd want him to do a button hook or a fly, or I'd want him to, you know, go to the flat and cut left. And we'd have plays where I'd put the ball right on his foot and he'd go to goal and score. So I love the indoor game, and I really, I think it. I'm surprised it didn't do better, but the story I heard is that Al Davis from the Oakland Raiders and the NFL, they came to the league after our third year and wanted to buy the league. And the commissioners of the league, Earl Foreman and Ed Tepper, said, look, if the NFL wants to buy it, us, we're not selling. It must be good.
Hmm.
But I think in hindsight, had that happened, the game may still be around. But very, very different sport for a goalkeeper.
Hmm. And you've been an analyst now, after you retired, for multiple World Cups, Olympics, and now currently Red Bulls analyst for MSG Networks. Was broadcasting always your plan for life after soccer?
No, again, just like I never, Steve, envisioned playing pro soccer, I had no idea I'd be in television. But, you know, you take what's in front of you. So I'll never forget the first time I did it. I was playing in an indoor league, you know, championship game out in San Diego, and I came up with an injury, and I had to sit out one game. You know, I didn't have to miss two games, but, you know, I couldn't play that night.
Mm-hmm.
And at the last minute, whoever was broadcasting us, they asked if I'd go into the booth and go three in the booth, because J.P. Della Camera, who's really a mainstay in the business, he was play-by-play. I think Seamus Manlam was the color. And they said, Shep, you know, I couldn't suit up, so I couldn't be on the bench. They said, why don't you jump up there and go into the booth?
Mm-hmm.
I said, great. and so JP, many years later, called me and said, look, you were fantastic. This was 4 years later after I had retired.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, ESPN would like to use you. Are you interested? So I went up to ESPN, and then, you know, ironically, you never know what happens. I was also had formed a player agency. We rep players. Pelé was my partner. We had a global representation company.
Mm-hmm.
And before the Red Bulls, when the Major League Soccer started and the Metro Stars opened up, I went down to their office in New Jersey to meet with Nick Sakevich, who was the general manager at the time. And I went there to meet him about, you know, selling players or buying players. And when he saw me, he said, look, we need somebody for TV. Would you be interested? So I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I started out on the sideline at Giant Stadium. JP Della Camera was in the booth with MSG. Tommy Smith was the color analyst. And I was the sideline reporter for a couple of years before I moved up into the booth. So, look, I grabbed the opportunity and ran with it because, again, as a kid growing up in New York, what's bigger than MSG?
Right.
I'm a Garden guy. I used to go to every heavyweight fight there. I'm a huge Knicks fan. So, you know, to work for MSG and be broadcasting now in my 20th year, you know, it doesn't get any better than that for me.
Hmm. I have to ask you about the state of USA soccer. There's a lot of discussion about the approach. On the men's side, they didn't qualify for the last World Cup. There's some positive feelings about players like Christian Pulisic. Where do you think U.S. men's soccer stands compared to the rest of the world?
Yeah, look, U.S. soccer has been in the news for all the wrong reasons. And look, bottom line is I think the U.S. soccer, their governing body, the administration, the way the sports run, I think it's an unmitigated disaster. I would throw them all out tomorrow because they're all what's happening is, and we go back to the, you know, not qualifying for the World Cup. That's no surprise. We haven't qualified for two Olympic cycles, and it's all because of how quickly the sport has grown in this country, and how people are chasing the money. Right. It's all about the money. This developmental academy that they finally trashed.
Right, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, it was a disaster to begin with. I mean, the idea was good, but then you got people involved. And what do people want? You know, people want power, control, and money. They didn't care about the kids. We developed no players. Pulisic didn't come through that. We developed zero players in 15 years of that developmental academy. Hmm. You're talking, and you mentioned Tab Ramos and Tony Meola and John Harkes. We developed many more players before they went with the academy system. Because what they, and look, I'm not saying they're not some good people there, but philosophically, the thing is broken. It's just broken because the Latino kid in Chicago, he's never getting a shot. The black kid in L.A., he's not getting a shot. This is strictly who can afford it. Right. And even when they, you know, give scholarships and lose money doing it, it's still a very elitist. It's an elitist system. And that's the opposite of what sports are. Right. It's the opposite of what sports are. So I don't have an answer except throw everybody out and start all over. Look, soccer all around the world, Brazil and Argentina, Colombia, South America, Central America, Europe, Asia. It's the most, and you know soccer, Steve. Mm-hmm. It's easy to teach a player how to destroy rather than to create. It's a creative sport. Mm-hmm. We have to teach our kids to be brave and skin somebody on the dribble. Not when they're 7 years old. Let's spread out, pass the ball, get rid of it. Keep four in the back because we want to win a trophy. No, you have to encourage. Look, the Dutch in the 1980s was total soccer. There was no such thing as a left back, a right back, a center back, a central midfielder. You've got to go, if you're a soccer player, you've got to be able to dribble, shoot, tackle, defend, head the ball, get forward, you know, dribble. So our whole system, what we do so well in this country, doesn't suit soccer. Right? Mm. The organization, the structure. All we have to do is provide fields, inner city, suburbs, provide fields, roll the ball out. Soccer players will develop on their own. Mm. I mean, we're stifling the growth of the sport here.
And then you look at the other side, the women's side, they've had tremendous success. Why do you think they have compared to the men?
Well, you know, Title IX. I mean, so we were just way ahead of the rest of the world when it comes to the women's game.
Right.
So we have been winning based on athleticism, and that's going away. I mean, our women are not going to continue to dominate because the rest of the world, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, Korea, they're catching up. We just got a head start. And look, I love our women. I think they're superb, but they're going to fall prey to the same administrative constraints that the men game have had. Mm-hmm. I mean, our women are rock stars, but it's not going to last because of the way we're running youth girl soccer in this country. We're going to do the same thing that we've done to the men.
Right. And then, you know, recently U.S. soccer said that the women don't deserve equal pay because they're less skilled.
Yeah, well, you know, if he didn't resign, he should have been fired.
Right.
But again, that whole group should have been fired. They should have thrown him out. Throw them all out and start all over. Look, I'm being facetious. You can't do that.
Right.
And there's some good people there, but they got caught up in control, power, money, rather than the good of the game. The good of the game is every child, every boy, every girl, every religion, every color, every ethnicity being afforded the opportunity to play the sport. And then out of 300 million people, however many million people we have here, we could be great. I mean, how is it that Uruguay, maybe a population of 3 million people, is perennially 100 times better than us? It right. just doesn't make any sense, right?
Right.
So this country loves the sport. Get the administrators out of the way and let the kids, you know, love the game. Again, every child, every ethnicity, every background, inner city, suburb, and we'll turn out great teams. But we're stifling it.
I did see one Eric Winalda came out and said that even some referees at the Development Academy level said the emotion wasn't there. And he traced it back because they weren't playing for their town or their school, and people had a little more pride when they did that. Do you think that's a little something to it as well?
Yeah, 100%. I agree with Eric, which is not a surprise. Right. I mean, Eric's a loose cannon, but he's right. You can't take the passion out of this game. We're too robotic, and part of the DA Developmental Academy was you can't play for your high school. Well, that, you know what? That's sick. You know, if you have a child, you want your children, boy or girl, to enjoy the socialization at that age that sports brings to boys and girls. Mm-hmm. And what better place to do it in your high school? Not in some academy system in Bradenton, Florida. Right. It's just counterintuitive to what sports are all about. And again, soccer is the most free-flowing, creative sport around. But you watch our kids play at any age group right now, they're very robotic, very mm-hmm. robotic. And that doesn't cut it in worldwide, you know, world level soccer.
You know, I saw that in collaboration with Port Washington Soccer, you started Shep Messing Soccer. What made you get involved in that?
That's, you know what, Steve, good segue into this conversation, because all the things I've been talking about or why I started it, because I saw youth soccer here, where I live in Port Washington and Great Neck, and I saw the things I didn't like. Right, they're lining up, they're doing drills, they're playing travel teams before they're ready. I started Shep Messing Soccer, which is strictly an intramural program mm-hmm. where it's 5 against 5. Where each kid's going to get a lot of touches on the ball. No goalkeeper, 5v5, short-sided game. These kids, the more they touch the ball, the better they're going to be. Mm-hmm. We're so anxious at a youth level to get them in travel leagues and tournaments and all the nonsense that takes the fun out of the game. Mm-hmm. And that's what Shep Messing Soccer is. Put the fun back in the sport. Many touches on the ball, 5 against 5, roll the ball out and go play. And very limited instruction. We do 5 minutes, one technical skill. Here's how you strike the ball. And now let's go play. If you're going to become good, it's going to be become because your boy or girl goes home and bangs it off the garage door.
Right.
Or juggles in the living room and knocks a lamp over. and instead, youth soccer is such a billion-dollar business that we lose sight of what we're trying to do for the kids.
Right. Wow. Well, Shep, I appreciate all your thoughts, your tremendous stories, and appreciate your time.
Well, I love what you're doing, and look, hopefully this too shall pass, but I listen to your show. I'm going to promote it. And I'll come on anytime with you. So great job you're doing, Steve. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, Shep. Take care.
Take care, buddy.
I really love how honest and candid Shep is on all topics. From the Bronx to the Olympics to Studio 54, he has certainly lived an entertaining life. What an amazing energy. On the next episode of Mike Check on Sports, I'll catch up with the voice of the National Hockey League. It's the one and only Doc Emrick. Take care. Brush your hair.